Let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for bringing us together today. I ask your blessing upon all those gathered here. I ask that you let your spirit of wisdom and truth enter the hearts and minds of these men and women, and that you send your grace upon us that we may have hope during this time when it is difficult to see the good in this world. Help us to daily see the beauty of your creation. Soften our hearts so that we can listen to those we disagree with. Yet grant us a will of steel to remain steadfast to your teachings, to speak the truth, and to be the brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, and fathers and mothers that you have called us to be. We ask this all in Christ's name. Amen. So it is truly an honor to be here today. I want to first of all thank Molly Smith for this invitation and for the wonderful job she and her staff have done to make this event a success. And it truly is more than just a conference. Take a look around at the people here in this room. These are friends. These are family that are bound by the call to defend the sanctity of life and to defend our country against a culture that will, if left unchecked, destroy the American tradition and Western culture. And with that, I applaud and thank all of you for being that light in the darkness to so many. And let there be no doubt that you are the last defense in salvaging and strengthening our God-given rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Do not forget this, because this is not a time to be proud or humble, but to simply appreciate what we need to do and get the job done. Okay? We have a mission, and we have to do it. Everybody agree? Okay. At least we're on the same page there. So when Molly and I first spoke, she mentioned that she would like a talk that focused on the judicial system and the strategic considerations that go into the decision to litigate a case and whether there may be other options outside of litigation that lead to judicial victory. So I spent some time reflecting on this, and I contemplated what exactly was the role of the judiciary in America. How is it used? Who are the key players? And even though I'm a lawyer and I deal with the judicial system on a daily basis, it really was a fruitful exercise for me. And today, what I would like to do is share a few of these thoughts with you, with the hope that these reflections will inspire greater dialogue on our approach as a collective movement to dealing with this powerful and decisive entity within our government. Now, as a child growing up, I grew up in upstate New York, actually 4 hours here from Cleveland. I, like most, if not all of you, I'm sure, watched The Wizard of Oz. Okay, and you may have noticed from the title of my talk, okay, you're going to see where I'm going. So while we all saw the movie at different times and at different ages, I think we all can agree that it was a movie that left a lasting impression on us. And each of us, I'm sure, could watch the movie and take something a little different away from it. Now, according to my mom, and I'm not sure what to make of this, and I'm not sure why I'm actually divulging it to you all today, but apparently I was deeply saddened when Dorothy threw the water on the Wicked Witch of the West and she died. Okay, now I know there's others of you out there right now saying, yes, I also felt that. But I'm not going to make you raise your hands because you know who you are. But as I was thinking about this talk, the plight of Dorothy kept coming back to me. And as I reflected on the plot of The Wizard of Oz, I actually found that there was a correlation, okay, between this great movie and the judicial system in America. All right? And I know you're all right at the edge of your seats right now, okay? So here it comes. So let's consider for a minute the plight of Dorothy. All right. Now Dorothy, all right, she suffered an injustice on multiple levels. Okay. First, her little dog Toto, right, was accused of biting old Miss Gulch. All right, and was unlawfully taken from her. That's horrible. All right. And then, all right, through no fault of her own, she lands on the Wicked Witch of the East and kills her. all right, and incurs the wrath of her wicked sister. All right, I mean, this is a bad day. All right, and then all of a sudden, all right, out of nowhere, really, all these little voices start popping up and bombard her with encouragement and assurance and optimism that she simply needs to find the great wizard. All right, and this wizard is just, and he's fair, and he's wise, and the wizard will see her case, and he will give her exactly the relief that she needs. And Dorothy, all right, is filled with great hope and expectation at that point. She launches down the yellow brick road. They're skipping and singing, and they're on their way to see the Wizard of Oz. And the sun is shining in the new Technicolor world that came out, and the birds are chirping. Everyone is happy. All right, it's a great day. But we all know what happened when she arrived. Okay, the wizard was not what she expected. All right, the great and powerful wizard sends her on a wild goose chase, has her jumping through hoops, and at the very end, Dorothy realizes that the wizard is a fraud, a sham, okay, and completely distorts her entire view of this journey that she's been on. She questions her purpose, and she is thrown into despair. Now let's assume for a second that it ends there, okay? That through all the toils and tribulations, Dorothy is left with nothing. The wizard does not grant her wishes, justice is not served, and what is good and fair remains out of her reach with no further recourse available to her. Now that indeed would have been a very sad ending to that story. But is not this hypothetical ending symbolic of the reality of life within the judicial system? Okay, think about this. After all, every case, there are at least two sides, all right? One of whom, especially in high-stakes litigation that involves social issues or rights, one of those is going to walk away feeling like an injustice was propagated by the court because they're going to lose. Now, our individual perception of the legal system can be mixed, right? I mean, we make jokes about it. We dread receiving that jury duty notice in the mail. We've all been there. Some of you are younger, maybe not yet, but it's going to happen, all right? But when push comes to shove and we are forced to enter into the legal arena, I think we have hope that justice is going to be served. Yet so much hinges on the court that we are in, and the court we are in is influenced by two key factors, okay? The judge and the jury. Now, winning the jury war is very challenging. All right, and depends largely on who is in the jury pool on any given day and then who actually shows up for jury duty, both of which are unpredictable, and the tendencies of the jurors also depend on the jurisdiction in which the court's located. Okay, so for example, a jury pool in a metropolitan area may be more favorable to a plaintiff in a Second Amendment guns case than would a jury pool in a rural area that's comprised of hunters. Okay? So you have to deal with the jury itself, who's going to be on the pool. And then you have the whole jury selection process, where the attorneys and the jury consultants and the parties all gather in a very short period of time, all right, to select a hopefully a favorable jury. But there's no guarantee that everyone on that jury is impartial or unbiased because you can't read everybody's mind. All right, and we could spend a whole day talking about just this jury phenomenon, but we're going to save that for another time. Okay, because the other factor, the judge, is what we're going to discuss in more detail today. And just as Dorothy put so much faith in this idea of the wizard, so do we put faith in this idea of a judge. And just as Dorothy anticipated that the wizard would be wise and fair and just, so do we also expect the same from judges in our courts, and rightly so. However, just as Dorothy learned during her quest, we also take a risk by entering into the legal system, that the judge may not be what we expect. Now, I want to be very clear that there are many, many great and just judges in this country, okay? Many of whom I practice in front of daily and work close in my profession. My point is not directed to any generalizations of judges, their character per se, but the reality is no matter how much we try to prevent it, the judicial system is wrapped up in the political machine. And the selection, appointment, and election of judges is a strategic process. And when it comes to social issues, religious liberty, and the like, the ideology of the judges does make a difference. Okay. So how do we, as a movement, address the issue of judges? How do we see behind the curtain and discover the true identity of the wizard? Well, the typical means, of which most of us that have had any dealings with politics know, is that you put considerable amount of time and effort into the selection process of judges. Okay. For instance, you know, in Missouri, I'm from Kansas City. In Missouri, there are areas of the state where judges are elected. Okay, and efforts are put towards those elections. In other areas of Missouri, they have what's called the nonpartisan process, whereby a panel of attorneys and a couple civilians elect a panel of nominees, and that panel of nominees goes to the governor, who then selects who's going to fill the vacancy. Missouri kind of started that process a while ago, and a number of states have picked that up. But it has its own issues. And we all know the federal process of appointment and nomination of judges, which is extremely politically motivated. So while the process varies, this mechanism for dealing with the selection of judges is well formed. It's well established. And it basically boils down to certain factions pushing to have people of their own ideology sitting behind the curtain. Okay? And while this is an important process to consider and evaluate, I'm not going to focus on that today. Okay? I'm going to focus on an alternative means of addressing the issue of judges. Something that came out of my reflections on this topic, and one that is not being utilized to its fullest potential, and that we as a coalition, I believe, should examine. Because once the judges are appointed, some are appointed for life. Okay, so we really can't change the man behind the curtain once appointed. I mean, that's tough. They already have their seat of power. So I pose to you today, you know, how do we get to the person before they become the wizard and sit behind the curtain? Now, before I present the alternative, I necessarily have to go into some statistics. Some of you may have heard before, but nonetheless are troubling statistics and directly impact the character of every future wizard of America. All right? These are statistics, so you might want to pinch yourself to stay awake, because this is going to be, you know, it's going to be a math part, all right? But it's a depressing part of the talk. Now, the University of California at Los Angeles conducts an annual college senior survey. And this is done through the Higher Education Research Institute, or I'm just going to call it HARI, all right? Where college seniors in various institutions of higher education across the country complete a questionnaire, and the organization, you know, does their analysis of it and releases a report. Some years there's a full report, some there's a summary. Now, 2007, 2008, 2009, okay, HARI released full reports on its analysis of the college senior survey. And I'm going to get into a couple of the findings. So let's start in the middle. Okay, so in 2008, and just to put the year in context, when these seniors were graduating, presidential elections were ramping up. The economy was not doing very well still. And the Afghanistan and Iraq wars were still there. So that's what these seniors were coming out kind of in the background. So in 2008, 29.7% stated that they considered themselves liberal their freshman year of college. At graduation, 39.1% identified themselves as liberal, okay, which is a 9.4% increase. 9.4%. In contrast, 28.7% considered themselves conservative freshman year. However, at graduation, 22.5% considered themselves conservative, which is a negative 6.2% decrease. So at the beginning of college, there was roughly a 1% difference in those that considered themselves liberal and conservative. By the end of 4 years, we have a 17% shift difference in favor of being liberal. Now, just to exemplify what flows from this kind of liberal mentality in this subject population, here are some other relevant findings. First, 48.6% said they felt abortion should be legal when they were freshmen. At graduation, 60.5% of them said abortion should be legal, which is an 11.9% increase. 56% said they felt as a freshman that same-sex marriages should be allowed. At graduation, 69.3% agreed with same-sex marriages, a 12.8% increase. Now, just in case you think this may have been an anomaly year, okay, let's take a look at 2009. 2009, 29.8% considered themselves liberal freshman year. At senior year, 39%. So a 9.2% increase, which is consistent with 2008 year. In contrast, 30.3% considered themselves conservative freshman year, but at graduation that dropped to 23.7%, a negative 6.6 decrease. Also consistent with the other year. Starting 2009, there was actually, the conservatives' view was actually 0.5% above the liberal view entering college. By the time of graduation, the shift was 15.3% in favor of liberal. Again, this is consistent with what we saw in 2008. On the other topics, abortion rights went from 51.6% at freshman year to 63.8% at graduation, 12.2% shift. Support for same-sex couples marrying went from 59.3% at freshman year to 72.8% at graduation, 13.5% shift. And more of the same for the 2007 report. In 2007, the shift from liberal to conservative was 15% in favor of liberal. Support of abortion shifted 12.9% in favor of being in favor of it. And support of same-sex marriages shifted 10.3% in favor. All right, so we have 3 years of statistics. All right, all asking the same questions, looking at the same issues, and across a variety of different institutions. And now for the kicker of all this stuff. You may be sitting there thinking, well, the institutions involved must have just been public institutions. Couldn't possibly have had any sort of religious affiliation with them. The shocking part is that for the 2007 report, 22% of the schools that were involved were Catholic universities. And another 30.3% were other religious universities. Okay, so 52.3% of the schools had some religious affiliation. Let this sink in for a second. Okay, in 2008, 19.6% were Catholic universities, and another 38.5% were from some other religious college. And in 2009, 20.7% Catholic universities, another 29.7% were from religious universities. So for each of these years, okay, of all the statistics I went through, 2007, 2008, 2009, okay, almost half, in some cases more than half, of the universities involved in those studies had some religious affiliation. So this is the state of our colleges and universities. It's devastating. Now, while there are great organizations out there working to evangelize and bring the faith and conservative values to college campuses, including, for instance, groups like Focus and St. Paul's Outreach, and there are many others, the reality is that there are simply not enough resources available right now to witness to everyone in college. For instance, in 2009 through 2012, the total enrollment of full-time and part-time students in a post-secondary institution in America was approximately 20 million students per year. Okay? That's a lot. And again, while we certainly need to continue to support the work of campus reform initiatives so that college students can be exposed to traditional values, and we certainly need to encourage and support the groups that are working on campus to bring this truth to the students, for purposes of the present discussion today, it's impossible for us to look at 20 million plus students and even make a wild guess who someday may be considered for a judicial appointment, right? It's a huge pool from which to even remotely guess, okay, you have it. You may someday be a judge, and you know, we can work on him. It's too big of a population. Here's another fact for you. What is the one job requirement for judges that is generally accepted and required in America? Okay? That's a judge should or has to be a lawyer. Right? Think about it. Makes sense. Okay? And barring a handful of specialty courts, this requirement is more or less expected throughout this nation. And that means, if you follow that and make that assumption, then every judge has, at some point in time, had to go to law school. All right? So let's compare the 20 million plus college student pool to the law school pool. All right? In the 2012 to 2013 law school year, there were 2,001 law schools in the United States, with a total enrollment of 150,113 students, with 46,478 students graduating in 2013. And these numbers are fairly consistent over the past 5 years. So this reduces the pool significantly, right? We go from this vast pool of college students, 20 plus million, down to a group of now 150,000. It's better. Not perfect, but it's better. So let's put all this into context. So first, the undergraduate college pool is vast, okay, and creates, in creating an initiative to identify and educate potential future judges, you know, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it sure seems like it is. Second, undergraduate students are coming out of college more liberal in their views on social issues, which impacts the ideology of those students as they are entering law school and who will someday be judges, okay? I don't think anybody can disagree with that. Third, the pool of potential judges is dramatically decreased if we just focus our attention on law schools, reducing this pool of people from 20 plus million to roughly 150,000 across the 201 law schools for any particular year. And fourth, all the judges in America will likely come out of this pool of law students. So it is here that my reflections brought me. And I know he's taking a picture of me, but I'm going to take a drink. Okay. All right, so it's here that my reflections brought me. We simply cannot wait until the lawyers are nominated to be judges and expect then to impact the mindset of the judiciary. Okay. Generally, they're older individuals at that point when they get the appointments. They're set in their ways. So we must find a way to intervene earlier in their legal career. And this, I believe, leads to a two-tiered approach. Okay, with the two tiers being, one, the law school years, okay, and the second tier being the postgraduate years. Now, I propose, okay, that if we as a united and committed coalition can support initiatives that influence these two tiers, that we really could impact the judiciary in this country. Now, I'm not going to stand here today and say I have every little piece of this figured out. But what I am going to tell you is that our failure to devote some time and energy to this, to trying to impact the judiciary in this way, will result in problems for us in the future. Okay, I am confident enough to say that today. Now, let me first comment on the second tier. Okay, so these are the individuals postgraduate. Okay, they graduated from law school. They may be working. They're starting their careers. They're out in the general population. Now, within the legal community, there are already in existence various faith-based conservative organizations that provide a community of support for lawyers. These groups provide local chapters, they have national conferences, they do lecture series, they do networking, all these things for their members. And they do conduct outreach to bring in new members. So that includes the National Lawyers Association, of which I'm involved in, Christian Legal Society, J. Reuben Clark Law Society, which is a Mormon group, and others. And I'm actually pleased to report to all of you today that at my office yesterday in Kansas City, a group of Catholic lawyers, judges, politicians met from across the nation, and we formally voted to establish the Catholic Bar Association. Okay? And the mission of the Catholic Bar Association is to promote the Catholic faith within the legal profession and encourage its members to live a life in accordance with their Catholic faith and to carry their Catholic faith and practice it in their practice of law. Okay? And we're going to, so the goal of that bar is to build a community of Catholic attorneys and eventually have law school chapters. Okay? And there's never before been an international organization of Catholic attorneys. So this is truly a historical moment in the church and is breaking news. They told me I could tell everybody here today. So please pray for this initiative. But I only raise this to make the point that there are organizations in existence for this period of time, this tier two phase of post-graduation, and other groups that are rising up with this mission to evangelize and educate lawyers after graduation. But however, admittedly, these groups need to do more to collaborate with one another, and it is a priority of the National Lawyers Association to reach out and form these collaborations, because I think collaboration is vital right now. If your organization that you're involved isn't reaching out to other organizations in your mission, then you need to consider doing that. But the reality is the lawyers graduating from law school, unless they've been exposed to something during law school, they may not have a desire to join one of these national groups. Okay, so that brings us back to this tier one, the law school years. So I really want us to take a look now at the law school years and try and figure out how we can build a yellow brick road for these law students and put them on the right path then so that it then carries over into their career. Now, I was blessed to be a part of the founding of Ave Maria School of Law. Okay, I was in the first graduating class of that law school. So I was there from the beginning. And I look back with extreme gratitude on my formation as an attorney there with classes by Judge Robert Bork, Judge James Ryan, and Professor Charles Rice. And as many of you know, Professor Rice passed away last week. He's a true giant among men and a voice for the unborn, and it was a loss to all of us with his passing. But being a part of that unique law school experience, having solid Catholic formation intertwined with a legal education, sadly is not the experience of many law students. So I'm going to challenge us to take a closer look now at law school and look at this as an opportunity of outreach, okay, to law school students. And that this time spent in law school is perhaps the last opportunity for us in our movement to present the values and arguments of traditional morality to them. Perhaps the last opportunity to let them experience why we believe what we believe. And at a minimum, give them an experience of our side that is positive and logical and hopefully persuasive, such that those who will someday sit on the bench may see the nature and benefits of our way of life early on in their career. For while we may not be able to change the wizard once he gets behind the curtain, we may be able to impact the future wizard before the curtain falls. Okay. So the question then becomes, how do I engage these students? And I pose that the most effective way to do it is really, really simple. And that is to develop a personal relationship with them. And this means inviting them into our lives. Okay? Now, this might be a radical concept here, because I don't think anybody really thinks about going to a law school and saying, hey, hi, you know? You know, in my opinion, a successful initiative on this level does not start by just, you know, taking pamphlets and hanging them up in the schools or bringing in lectures and hoping that the kids will show up to it. But it has to start with local families taking the initiative to reach out and invite these students, and they are students, into their homes. Now, you've heard over and over again, including, I'm sure, numerous times this weekend, about the importance of family and the perversion of the family in our society, right? Well, the best witness against this false cultural perversion is to let someone see that it is not true. Let me tell you a little something about law students, having been one myself, okay? It is stressful. It's competitive. It can be cutthroat. And it can be lonely. But guess what? Law students have to eat, right? They're still in the community. Even though they're in law school and they may come from all over the country to go to this particular area, they are, for the 3 years, part of your community. And it is a 3-year process. You know you're going to have them there for 3 years, so that's a lot of time to engage them. And as we have come to learn through the mission field, if you want to truly impact a person's life and get them to really listen to your point of view, you need to start by nurturing a relationship. It's the most effective way to do it, right? You get to know somebody first, and then you have a conversation. And remember, while we do not know who it's going to be, a select handful of those law students will someday end up sitting on the most powerful court in the world. Think about that. And they could be right here in your community. Now, can there really be any greater witness to the beauty of family, of the joy of children, of the value of family prayer, than letting someone actually experience this through our example? Now, my wife Kathy and I, I'm actually happy to say that my sister-in-law, Bridget, who's going to Steubenville, is here. Actually, today she came up. But my wife Kathy and I lead a group of young married couples through the Heart of the Redeemer community in Kansas City. Now, this is a Catholic covenant community. And the single most important component of our ministry is opening our lives and homes to these young couples. We listen to them. We engage them. And then, when we have a relationship with them and the respect is developed, we help them as best we can by offering them advice, counsel, and encouragement in their marriages and how they live their life, how they view the world. Now, we are not perfect, okay? Our kids are not always angels, all right? The house oftentimes looks like a tornado blew through it. That's another Wizard of Oz reference, in case you didn't pick that up, okay? But we do our best to present the reality of life to them and show them that this union, right, between a man and a woman is as it is for a reason. Okay? That the blessing of children is a reality even in the act of just being open to children. And that it is okay to live a life that is countercultural. And more amazingly, that such a countercultural life can even lead to happiness. That's quite a notion, isn't it? We can actually be happy in all this madness that we have. But I say the same model we could use for interacting with law students. Okay. Now, many law schools already have student chapters of whether it's the National Lawyers Association or the Christian Legal Society. They have like-minded organization chapters that are there. Okay. And it may just be simply connecting with those organizations. identifying which law schools are next to the organization you're involved with, connecting with them, seeing what you can do. If there is a chapter of one of those other groups at the law school, connect with those students and begin the discussion on what you can do to engage the students as a community. And not just the students in those chapters, but you really want the ones that aren't a part of those chapters. Those are the ones you want to reach out to and get to know and bring them into your lives. Now, the approach may vary from group to group, from school to school, but the mission would be the same, and that would be to create these and foster these relationships as a community, as a parish, as a church, as whatever, as an organization that you have with these students, and really take it to heart and take them under your wing to as much as they'll let you. And there may be some benefit to letting a national organization oversee this, but the success or failure of this type of initiative would hinge on the commitment of those involved, right? I mean, anybody that's been involved in mission work and outreach know that it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of heart and sweat. So the commitment of those involved in setting up that outreach and development would take most of the work. There's no doubt about it. I'm definitely not going to stand up here and say that it would be an easy process or an easy initiative to establish. But once the relationships are made, then you have the opportunity to help them. You know, you can help them by giving them reading materials, by mentoring opportunities with lawyers, good lawyers that may be in your community, job searching, bringing speakers to the schools from your organization, all of which could be done by working within your organization or with others, but all for the benefit of these students at the schools. And I truly believe that if such an initiative is started, and law students knew that they and their family, and a lot of them do have families when they're in law school, if they knew that there was a place that they could go, a family that they could be with, a place they could go to have a meal, share a meal with a family, I think they would really be open to it, and I think it would make a difference. So as we draw to an end, let's look back to Dorothy and her companions during her journey to find the wizard. Okay, so what happened at the end of the story, right? People changed, right? The mind of the scarecrow, the heart of the tin man, the courage of the lion. All of them were changed. And how were they changed? Through the relationships that they developed along the journey. It made a difference. And any one of them someday, okay, could be the wizard. So too can we change the hearts and minds of these future judges and provide them with examples of a courageous life if we but open our doors and invite them in. Okay. So thank you all very much. Really enjoyed this opportunity today. And I'll field questions for whoever wants to.